This is Michael Reed Trice with Religica. I'm speaking today with Dr. Patricia O'Connell Killen, who is professor of religious studies and a senior university fellow at Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. A historian and theologian, her scholarship focuses on Christianity in North America, especially on the Pacific Northwest. Killen is the primary editor of Religion and Public Life in the Pacific Northwest, The Nun Zone. Today, on the 40th anniversary of the eruption of Mount St. Helens, we are talking about pathways to wisdom, how we carry it, when we practice it, and how we encounter gratitude, and of course, the nuns. Take a listen.
I'm Patricia Killen. I am a farm girl from Oregon who was the first person in her family to go to college and discovered at university that some of the kind of questions I had been thinking about but told not to ask because they get you into trouble actually were okay to ask. So I spent 40 years as a faculty member and also 11 years as an administrator in faith-based institutions. I'm a historian of religion in North America and have done a great deal of my work on Catholicism in the U.S., but particularly have worked on religion, spirituality, and public life in the Pacific Northwest. And I always have thought that being a professor or being a university vice president plus $1.50 got me on the bus. So I was always raised not to be overly impressed with some of the trappings that go with university life.
Maybe that's one of the ways why you've been such a respected public intellectual, because it seems to me, in my experience of the work that you've done, even in my limited experience, is that you're approachable. And there's both in your texts and in the way you present ideas, an invitation for others to learn, which I think is the best kind of public engagement and respect for the commons. And you've written and spoken widely about the role of religion in society, more specifically about the public appetite for religion as a force for authoritative meaning-making, let's say, in our lives. Given where the role of religion is in society today, which is a big thing to say, but what are we willing to see today, do you think, as spiritually viable or valuable? And frankly, what are we no longer able to stomach about religion today?
Well, that's a question I've been thinking about for quite a while now. Because, and I sometimes say what I really want to live to be a very old woman, because I think the really big question that we're up against, whether we are Christians or Muslims or Buddhists or Jews or what have you, is given all the kinds of changes that have gone on in our world, in the way we organize as human beings, in what's happening with institutions, the economy, the environment, and everything else, how is it that wisdom is going to be remembered and passed beyond the lifespan of a single generation? It's been for a very long time the role of religious institutions and communities to do that. But one of the things about the second half, particularly of the 20th century and into the 21st, is the growing suspicion of institutions and whether they're trustworthy. And I think one of the things that we're wrestling with, and it wouldn't necessarily be put in these words, but religious traditions and communities have carried or been, if you will, a space where people experienced in some moments the sublime. And the question is, now that we are so aware of how flawed institutions are and the degree to which they have embedded in them structures of oppression, racism, arrangements of power, inequality, what have you, can we still relate to historic faith traditions in a way that allows them to be a site where we might get in touch with the sublime? We're very suspicious of overarching narratives, and that's part of what our traditions give us. Mm-hmm. They give us a story in which to locate ourselves. But if that story is perceived as biased and exclusive against women, against people of color, against sexual minorities, against those parts of God's creation that aren't human, then why should this story be trusted? So I've been thinking a lot about this. One of the things I've noticed in interviewing younger people is they tend to be oriented less toward the past and are more inspired by a vision of what's possible in the future and a kind of eschatological imagination that they're willing to walk with. And this is true of young people who are part of Christian communities and those who are not. So I think what we're looking for is how to be in touch with the deeper truths that are more than just my individual self or Michael, your individual self, at the same time that we keep our integrity. Because if there's anything I think people really loathe, and I really saw this a lot in my students starting in the 80s, but it just got more and more pronounced, is they loathe hypocrisy. They're desperate for leaders who have integrity. They don't necessarily have a developmental sense of integrity, and that creates a problem. I'll never forget one student who said to me, if something changes, it isn't true. And I said, well, do you love your mother now the same way you loved her when you were four? And the student said, no. And I said, well, might it not be possible that our ways of being in relation to the divine evolve and develop too? And the student had a hard time with that because somehow if it wasn't absolutely stable, it couldn't be true. I think we're in a really tough moment around how do we make the wisdom of historic faith traditions accessible in ways that are meaningful in people's lives. And I'm not talking about watering down anything. I'm not talking about dumbing down. I'm talking about, given the world we're in, what are the pathways, if you will, what are the bridges to the encounter with ideas or practices or experiences of community that allow someone to experience themselves as held, as part of something bigger, as worthy of existence, and as gifted to contribute to this wonderful mystery that is the very fact we exist.
I wonder, as you're speaking, if there's a correlation between those who are wisdom-seeking, looking to the future, maybe hoping, but distrustful of some of the structures as you're identifying of the past. And in particular, you're making me wonder about your work on the nuns in the Pacific Northwest of the U.S., but also in clusters in the U.S. and around the world. You described the arrival of nuns and really recalibrating how they understand their connection to the sacred, which makes me think it must be one part brittle, the other part hopeful. For those who don't know, what are these nuns that you have in mind, and how do you understand their approach to the sacred further?
First of all, nuns are, N-O-N-E-S, nuns, are those people who, when asked in surveys, what is your religion, if any, answer none, N-O-N-E. We first started seeing this, there was the National Religious Identification Survey was done in 1990, and then the American Religious Identification Survey was done in about 2001. And those surveys were significant because they were some of the earliest that asked, what is your religion, if any? And what we saw in the research that came out in the first book, Religion and Public Life in the Pacific Northwest, The Nun Zone, was that 25% of the population in Oregon, Washington, Alaska were nuns, N-O-N-E-S, which put the region ahead of the rest of the country on that score. When you ask, you know, what are they? Very few of them in 2001 were naturalists, shall we say materialists or naturalists or humanists. Very, very few were atheists or agnostics. Most of them defined themselves as spiritual but not religious. And that spirituality took all kinds of forms. And in the 2001 study, they were mostly middle-aged people who owned their houses, whose kids were kind of grown. They were educated. Now, in more recent work that's been done, and Pew has picked up on this, and Gallup and other people who do polls, the nun phenomenon has increased significantly, and it has particularly increased among those under the age of 35. So well over a third of adults under the age of 35 in this country define themselves as nuns. And growing numbers of them now define themselves not only as no religion, but also as not being spiritual. And in a current project I'm working on with colleagues at the University of Victoria, where we're looking at Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, British Columbia is even ahead, and the growth in nuns is continuing. So I think what the nun phenomenon does is, one, it is confirmation that our religious institutions simply do not resonate with people in the way they used to. And people are putting together their spiritual life differently. In the Northwest, and this will be coming out in the book with the colleagues at UVic, nature, the being in nature, is one of the places where they experience what those of us out of a theologically trained world would say is some kind of transcendence. Being out in nature dislocates you. And the fact that we're doing this interview on the 40th anniversary of the eruption of Mount St. Helens is, I think, significant. Because what happened with Mount St. Helens was something that dislocated the human. Killed 57 people, massively changed a landscape, totally undid the geography in my brain, because that was a mountain I could see every morning when I would wash dishes and look out the kitchen window. So I think there's something going on among the nuns that they are, particularly young ones, they are looking for something that grabs them and won't let go. They are not just selfish narcissists. But they, whatever transcendence is for them, it has got to be profoundly embedded in lived experience. And we can use the term panentheist, where God is present in and through. We can talk about, you know, a kind of incarnational view. But there is a hunger to understand the whole. So nature is one of the real places where the nuns go and describe themselves as experiencing something we might talk about as transcendence or ecstasy. For some, it's activism. They find a cause, be it poverty, be it the environment, be it some other form of justice. And for some of them get into interesting kinds of what you would think of as prepper and apocalyptic movements. That's a smaller group of the young ones. So we don't know where this is all going. Oh, and the fourth place that they're going, and we're seeing this too in the work of writers like Margaret Wheatley, who has written about leadership a lot for decades. Some are focusing on creating humane local communities. For example, in Seattle, there is an organization called the Parish Collective, and they are working on what it means to be church in your actual concrete local place. I mean, when I think about the nuns, I think about a line that is attributed to Rahner and the Jesuit theologian Karl Rahner, but it also comes from the great sociologist of religion, Ernst Troeltsch. And the line runs roughly, in the future, Christians will be mystics or they'll be nothing at all. That's my paraphrase of it. I'm pretty close. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what I think I see happening with nuns, especially with the younger nuns. Because what they're asking in the face of environmental cataclysmic catastrophe that we're facing, they can't, by and large, use religion to avoid their own finitude in the way their parents and grandparents have been able to.
Could you say another word about that? How did those parents and grandparents avoid their own finitude with religion?
Well, religion, one strand of religion says, if you believe the teachings and you follow the rules, God will take care of you and things will turn out okay. It's kind of steady habits yields reward. One of the reasons there have been a lot of nuns in the Pacific Northwest from earliest Euro-American settlement, it's the place, institution of religion has never had the traction here it's had in other places, is the economy and the environment did not support steady habits reaps reward. It was an extractive boom and bust place. And when Mount St. Helens blows up, you know there's nothing you could have done to change or control that. So there is a way that being well-behaved and locating ourselves within our culture properly has historically, and particularly in the post-World War II period, was a way of trying to secure and order some existence and have some predictability. Side of religion is that not only is it something people have used to try and locate themselves within the ordinary world, but it's also the way we have dealt with extraordinary experiences. So when we think about Mount St. Helens, or when we think about, and we may talk about this later, the pandemic that we're in now, those are extraordinary. And they raise questions about what is God? Who is God? How does one relate to God? What difference does God make in this setting?
You mentioned that today is the 40th anniversary of the eruption of Mount St. Helens. In terms of a global crisis, whether it be the pandemic or a changing climate, also as a kind of rupture. We spoke about this recently together. History is pocked with ruptures that change our approach to religion thereafter. But Thomas Berry in his work discusses the Black Death, the plague of the 14th century, as a significant time of change for the role of religion in society. This pandemic is a bit like a rupture. Mm-hmm. Is it making us hungry for a new language about faith, only now emerging? And if that's true, what do you see as emerging on the other side of this particular rupture?
Well, I think this pandemic is a rupture. Certainly the Black Death in the 14th century changed a great deal. Among other things, some historians would say it gave us the beginnings of the middle class. And religiously, what people saw was it killed the royalty just like it killed the peons. And as a result, the whole experience eroded the theories of the divine right of royal of kings, if you will, that religion by that point very much kind of reinforced, even as the Pope would be in tension with royalty. There was this notion of a kind of divine right. So it really accelerated the movement towards ordinary people wanting direct experience of the divine, that you saw in some of the renewal movements and lay movements of the 13th century, and it probably in some ways propelled in directions toward the Reformation. Similarly, not so far past, the Great Lisbon earthquake of 1755 also was profoundly disruptive. The great American theologian Jonathan Edwards was trying to make sense of the justice of God in light of that earthquake and all the people that were killed. The pandemic is a disruption. It gives the lie to the notion that we are able to predict and control everything. Now, we're seeing different kinds of reactions. One of those reactions is to blame and punish. I mean, I find it my own self somewhat ironic that in all the efforts that the Congress needs to take to, and Jerome Powell of the Federal Reserve is telling the Congress to take care of people who are now unemployed through no fault of their own, we still have leaders in the Congress and the Senate who speak as if they consider this unemployment the fault of the unemployed, which is a deep American bias. So I think the pandemic is disruptive. It's disruptive in this country in one way. It is undercutting some of the darker sides of the American exceptionalist narrative. It is throwing onto relief and a bright spotlight onto, to mix my metaphors, the inanity of healthcare being tied to employment, given the kind of economy that we have and that is developing. That if we really want people to be doing the kind of work that makes them really productive and creative and builds wealth for the whole nation, you don't want them stuck in a job they hate but can't leave, because if they do, they'll have no insurance. Mm-hmm. And I think it also is making clear concentration of wealth. You know, I'm keenly aware that being at the end of my career and that I am not suffering in the way that my new colleagues are. I mean, my heart breaks for people who are just beginning in university teaching at this point, or how do I put this? The pandemic, it's disrupting a lot of things, but it's an opportunity.
Okay.
And one of the things I'm wondering about is, will we end up with leaders and a citizenship who will notice that those occupations and jobs that focus on human thriving matter? And that, in fact, we ought to be rewarding them justly. And if you look in the history of the United States, the pay, if you will, or salary for people engaged in jobs focused on human thriving in this country, has the gap between those kind of jobs and jobs in finance, in terms of revenue and income, has been widening since the mid-1960s. So what would happen if we rethought the significance of how we pay people who do the work of human thriving, from the garbage collectors to the preschool teachers?
That would assume something of a public conversation that could take place, and that we have a public that both yearns for and has the capacity to engage that kind of conversation. You've been in the field for a considerable time. What does your experience tell you about our readiness for that kind of change?
It is work to make it happen. But I think there is, especially among younger people, an openness to it. I mean, if you think about it, the kids who are graduating now from college, I shouldn't call them kids, the young adults who are graduating from college this year, remember the recession of 2008-09. So you've got coming out a generation who has a lot of good evidence for being a bit suspicious, to justify their suspicion on how wealth is distributed and allocated in this country. I think one of the challenges to the conversation is that there is a tendency towards perfectionism in the United States. So if an institution isn't perfect, it's of no value at all. If a person makes a mistake, they can't, you know, then we've got to erase them. And that's unhelpful. But when we actually can get people together in a room to talk about the things that matter to them, not to position in terms of which group do I belong to, but in terms of what is it going to take for this community, for our kids to be safe out in our yards, people do care about that. And we're seeing in this pandemic a lot of neighborliness. And not only that, while there's a great deal of concern about the kinds of mental health issues that people will be living with, and I think about the healthcare providers, I also think about all those families who have lost a loved one and that they were not able to be with them when they died or to grieve with others in the same way at a funeral, the way we would think. There is going to be a lot of mental health problems, but there's also research that's showing a lot of people are feeling less stressed and more satisfied.
In terms of the kinds of public displays, from art, public artwork, to people who are writing thank you notes on their garbage receptacles that they leave at the side, There's something about the societal need for significant change and the wisdom from our earlier conversation that needs to inform this generation. There's something about the nature of gratitude, isn't there, that should come from a place of wisdom and inform a healthy society. You and I have also had a conversation about this. What role does gratitude play in all of this in our lives, do you think?
Well, gratitude is essential, I think, to an apt recognition of how much we depend on each other. It's when I think about gratitude, and I look back over, just to make it autobiographical, I look back and realize it's totally not of my doing that I had great elementary school teachers, that I had an amazing kindergarten teacher, you know, that there were teachers and mentors in my life who saw in me what I didn't know was there, and how my entire life was a gift from my parents and my extended family and all these teachers and mentors. And so this sense of the kind of freedom and opportunity that I have had to be who I am and do what I've done comes from others. And what is there to do but to say thank you? When I think about gratitude, I think about delight, because there is a quality of delight to it. When it just wells up within you. Friendship, when one is grateful, one is connected to others in a very gentle way, without judgment. Freedom, and also I would say it's a kind of freedom that comes from accepting my finitude or my dislocation. I can't be grateful if I think I'm the center of the universe. Gratitude is a kind of sheer pleasure in being part of existence. This delight of existence, of beings, that is just so amazing and so rich. And we're seeing it in the notes to garbage collectors. We see it in, I was talking to a friend who lives in New York about the cheers and the music for the healthcare workers at the change of shift. I think all of those kind of public outpourings are really a kind of, if you will, spiritual effort. They are an expression of some spiritual instincts that people have that they may not have language for because they haven't grown up in traditions, or they grew up in religious traditions that they experience as so punitive they want nothing to do with them. It allows me to breathe into my finitude, the fact that I'm contingent, I'm going to die, without choking on fear. And it makes it possible to be in community and how to be in community without clinging. So there is a way that the play, and to use Christian theological language, the understanding of the Trinity or the nature of God as fundamentally communal, as a kind of pouring forth and filling, that experiences of gratitude give us a clue into what the delight at the heart of God is.
You took the question right out of my mind on this, in terms of whether there's a connection between gratitude and the sacred. There's something kind of bricks and mortar about gratitude. It is in the sinews, to use a different image, of what holds all this together, perhaps?
Oh, yes. I think there is. Because in moments of gratitude, self-loathing is impossible. And a fundamental suspicion that part of the spiritual journey is about is getting over the notion that God or the divine made a mistake in one's coming into existence. And so there is a way that in moments of gratitude, we are free to be who we are. And all of the unhelpful kinds of gremlin tapes that run through people's minds are silenced for a bit. And that's why I talk about it as delight and sheer pleasure. The Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, in trying to deal with some of these questions, talks about experiences of fullness. And what are experiences of fullness, kind of things that happen to us that we feel full, but we also realize that the fullness of existence, we can't contain it. And he sees these as glimpses of when people connect with the sacred.
You remind me of Martin Luther, who thought that ingratitude was a form of amnesia. Is there something we forget about ourselves? Is there a kind of forgetfulness or lack of memory around ingratitude somehow?
Yes. I think with ingratitude, fear diminishes our capacity to perceive what's around us. And in those moments of fear, we have a kind of compulsion to control, to compete, to punish. We deny our humanity and the humanity of others. One of the challenges we have with the market economy that we have, the way we've in the US set up value, it's based on scarcity. Mm-hmm. If we equate scarcity with value, we can't really see abundance. Nor can we see the dignity in the people around us if we always are competing to try and be the person of most value. I experienced this very vividly as a university administrator. I used to joke that I was going to run a workshop called How to Get Your Provost Fired. And what I was going to teach, wanted to try and facilitate in that workshop, was an opportunity for people to realize that if they would connect, and if they would share their aspirations, they would come up with bigger possibilities than they could have alone. And I'm sure some of my orientation there comes out of being off the farm and always wanting to put one more chair at the kitchen table to feed people breakfast, that this is about our ability to create. Walter Brueggemann, the famous Old Testament scholar, one of his essays talks about how newness is always a sign of the presence of God. And I think gratitude is always, there's always a kind of freshness and newness in it.
One final thought on gratitude I'd like to ask you about is the relationship between gratitude and power, because a good thing can be abused. So the precondition or the leaning toward gratitude can also be taken for granted.
It can, and I suspect you, and certainly I and others of our listeners, have been in experiences where someone was told to be grateful. I put telling somebody to be grateful in the same category as I put telling somebody that their suffering is fine because it was all in God's plan. So there is a way that gratitude can be misused. It can be used as a tool of power. It's the person, the individual, who has to experience and name gratitude for themselves. I can't tell them, in this situation, you should be grateful. And there's no way to will gratefulness. In that sense, gratitude is like joy. It's very powerful. It's very fragile. It cannot be controlled. Some people experience gratitude. It wells up in them enough that something happens, that it begins to be not just an intermittent welling up, but it tutors their dispositions. And so they are more inclined that way. But I think it takes a lot of love and a lot of grace, if you will, for that to be able to happen.
We mentioned earlier, today is the 40th anniversary of the eruption of Mount St. Helens.
Yes.
We think about integrity and gratitude and care and our connection to the sacred. As we end today, what does that mountain and the eruption tell us about who we are and what we need to think about next?
In the first 24 hours after that mountain erupted, the news broadcasts were that the ash was probably acidic, and as soon as it rained, it would kill hundreds of thousands of acres, which was, for me, terrifying. And it didn't happen. And there's a lovely little book called In the Blast Zone, which is essays by scientists and writer and artists who spent a week on Mount Rainier at the 25th anniversary, or excuse me, on Mount St. Helens. But one of the things that that explosion tells us is we don't know, because it has redone all the science around volcanology, and the ash that was to be deadly instead has profoundly fertilized and helped in agriculture. So I think the mountain tells us we are not the center of the universe. We are precious and dearly loved, but we're part of something bigger. My geologist friends always remind me we are here at the behest of the rocks. I think the mountain teaches us to be open to surprise, to newness, and not to be overly confident, and to be able to be amazed and awed.
You are listening to Religica. Check us out at religica.org and follow us on Facebook.